Do you see what happened in that video? Takes you a little bit, doesn't it, to catch what's going on? It's a brilliant, I think, picture in, you know, in systematic theology, which is going to put you to sleep just by saying the word. But they'll talk about how Jesus, the coming of the Christ child, is a hinge in the biblical story, but also in the ages. And, you know, that demonstrates the way in which Jesus becomes a kind of hinge, that everything gets flipped on its head. And that's what we look forward to. That's what we anticipate at Christmas time. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So let's open up to Isaiah chapter 9. And now we're going to be looking at verses 4 and 5. Now, I was accosted in a Starbucks a little over a month ago, and it was right around Remembrance Day, and I wasn't wearing a poppy on my jacket, and a stranger came up to me, a woman came up to me, and she said, "Where's your poppy?" And I said, "I don't wear poppies." And she kind of does one of these, and she goes, "Well, be a good Canadian and wear wear a poppy." And I'm thinking, okay, I'm not going to touch this one. And I just said, she goes, "Well, why not?" And so we had this brief conversation where I just said, because of my faith, I avoid demonstrations of nationalism. And she didn't really know what I meant by that. And she went on this long rant about, don't I care about freedom? And don't I want to show respect and concern for the people that have died for my freedom? And she says, "You know, freedom is not free." I said, "You're right, it's not." And then she turned and walked away in a huff. And, you know, I thought maybe she'd give me a poppy by the end, but she didn't. Now, the line, "Freedom is not free." Now, you don't hear that so much in Canada. Where I grew up, you heard it all the time. And there were all kinds of, you couldn't go to a football game without a military flyover and standing and holding your hand over your heart and singing a song that celebrated the rockets bursting in the air and the flag still standing. Now, Canada has a military tradition too. It's just not quite as strong. But this idea, freedom is not free, is ingrained in our consciousness in the West. And it comes from the American Revolution, and it comes from other revolutionary movements in Europe. It comes from this idea that if we don't have tanks and bombs and people with guns protecting us at our borders, the masses will run over us and we'll become oppressed. And so we celebrate that we have a military that's killing people somewhere else so that we can gather in our churches and worship God freely. Now, we never frame it this way, understand? But when we say freedom is not free, what we're saying is that the world is violent and hostile, and we can't trust it. And we need people killing on our behalf or exercising violence on our behalf so that we can enjoy the basic freedoms of job and security and health and things like that. Because if the world is left to itself, it's violent and it's chaotic and it's hostile. Freedom is not free. And in a violent world, it comes at the end of a sword. Now, we will also say, when we talk about freedom, one of the other things we'll talk about is not just freedom from others that want to hurt us. You know, we need SWAT teams and such protecting us to keep us free. But we also want to be free for certain things. And usually that gets boiled down to, we want to be free for the sale that's happening down at Walmart. Or we want to be free for a cheap book on Amazon.ca. Or we want to be free for, some great service, some great restaurant that's serving great food. We want to be free for experiencing the good things in life, which in our day and age tends to get reduced to consumable goods, things that we can buy and sell. But in a world that's violent and hostile, in a world where chaos lingers on the edges and threatens to overtake us, the things that we're free for, there's a cost to that as well. There is no such thing as a free lunch. You know, it's one of the other things that we'll learn. We're full of cliches today. See, there's a website I took that's out right now around Christmas time called slaveryfootprint.org. Has anybody seen this? It's I don't know who it's linked to. I haven't done a lot of research, so you might go and find out it's some sort of communist plot to take over the world. That I'm not suggesting everybody go to the website. It's simply an example. Slaveryfootprint.org. You can go on there and you take a survey, just a basic survey. You know, how many people live in your home? How big of a home do you live in? How many electronics do you have? How many articles of clothing do you have? How many sporting goods do you have? How many cars do you drive? And you go all the way through, and you click on all these things. And then it tells you in the end how many slaves work for you and what parts of the world they're working for you in. Now, let's back off. There's a big political agenda here. Slaves is maybe the wrong word, but what it's pointing to is the fact that lots of the things that we enjoy in the West come at the expense of others working for very, very low wages in parts of the world where there aren't any other options. So my iPhone is put together by factories that we know don't treat their workers very well and work against them when they try to organize to get better wages. My sporting goods that I have, I buy them cheap because they're made even cheaper by people making next to nothing that work extremely long hours. 48 slaves work for me. And I think I live a pretty, you know, moderate life. I don't collect things in excess, right? I don't think I do. And the survey came back, 48 slaves working for me. You see, we aren't just free from the people that want to hurt us because of our armies and our SWAT teams, but we're free for spending money on cheap goods and the freedom that we enjoy for purchasing things tends to come at the expense of others. Our freedom is not free. It comes at the end of the sword and it comes on the backs of people less fortunate. Freedom is not free. Now we have to remember when we read the book of Isaiah that Isaiah is talking from not the perspective of the wealthy middle-class Canadians. Isaiah is talking from the perspective of all the people that the Canadian government and our Canadian economics are trying to keep out. You see, Israel was a colony of Babylon, and Babylon was making the world safe for democracy at the time. The Babylonian army ran over Israel and took Israel into captivity. And Israel was essentially working on behalf of the Babylonians, a kind of slave people or a colonized people. And Isaiah is speaking on the behalf of those who are being oppressed by the world system. It wasn't working in Israel's favor. And so Isaiah says here in verse 4, looking forward to this day when God would hear the cries of his people and God would break through and overturn this system of oppression, that those who were not free from the ill will of others, those who were not free for the free purchase of things, but rather were the backs on whom the economy was running. Isaiah says, "For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you, O God, have shattered the yoke that burdens your people, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor." These are all images that come from farming, from beasts of labor. The yoke that you would put over the oxen to plow the fields, the rod that you would use to spur the oxen on. And that was the way they understood the way that they lived. They had no options. They were oppressed. They were beasts of burden for an empire. And Isaiah says, God will come. God will hear your cries and break through, and God will break the yoke that holds you. God will break the rod that is beating you. You will be free from being a beast of burden. You'll be free from your oppressor. And this is the pattern all through the Bible. When God's people become oppressed, God hears their cries and God responds and God breaks the cycle of oppression. And God's people are now free from those that might want to hurt them so that they could be free for being God's people. Now this reference to Midian, as on the day of Midian, it's bringing us back to the story of Gideon. It's a direct reference to the story of Gideon. Midian was an ongoing enemy of Israel. One of the big places where Israel and Midian squared off was the story of Gideon. Now, if you remember the story of Gideon, it starts in Judges chapter 6. And Gideon is the youngest of his family. He's a nobody. And at this time, the kind of oppression that Midian had on Israel was this. Every time the crops would be ready for harvest, the Midianites would flood in with their armies. They would steal all the crops, and then they would run back off to wherever it was that they would live at the time. And taking the crops away, the Israelites would be left then to go the rest of the year living on next to nothing. Now, when you're subsistence farmers, that's a big deal. There isn't a savings account to go draw from. This was life and death that Midian was doing. And so the Israelites would hide in caves, and they would hide their food in various places. When we first meet Gideon, he is hiding in a wine press trying to thresh the grain. Now, threshing the grain is this, it's a way of separating the kind of the wheat from the chaff. And they throw it up in the air and the heavy part drops and the chaff blows away. Well, when you're in a wine press, there's no wind. You want to thresh the grain out in the open. Gideon's doing it in a wine press. Why? Because he's hiding. So he's not doing a very good job of threshing, but at least he's holding on to his grain and the Midianites haven't taken it. So an angel of the Lord appears to Gideon while he's hiding in a wine press, and the angel of the Lord says, "Greetings, mighty warrior." Now, the irony of this is not wasted on Gideon. Me, mighty warrior? Look at me, I'm hiding. I'm the youngest in my family. If there's anybody who's not a mighty warrior, it's me. But God eventually convinces him. You know, the whole fleeces thing, and eventually God convinces him. So Gideon gathers an army. And God says, too many. And so there's all these tests that God has that he whittles it down to 300 people against thousands. And then Gideon with his 300 surround the camp of the Midianites. They bang on things. They make noise. And the Midianites, God confuses them and they fight each other. And then they flee because they think they're being attacked by a far superior force. All through the Bible, God frees his people. God hears the cries of his people, and he frees them from the oppressor in ways that it makes it obvious that only God could have done it. This was not a great warrior that freed Israel. This was the work of God, hearing the cries of oppression and taking the side of those less fortunate and freeing them from all that oppresses them. So Gideon gives chase to the army, and at some point in the chase, there's two towns that kind of don't help Gideon on his way to chasing them. And so Gideon turns to the towns and he says, I'm going to finish what I'm started, and we're going to kill the Midianite leaders. And when we come back, we're going to humiliate you as well, because you didn't show God's army any help. So Gideon chases down this army. He kills the leaders of the Midianites, and then he comes back to these towns. He says, see, I told you, you shouldn't have gotten in my way. And so he takes, with one of the towns, he takes a barbed plant and he beats the men in public and rips their skin with the plant. In the other town, he rips down a tower. And then the Israelites want to make Gideon king because he freed them. And Gideon says, no, only God should be our king, but I will take your gold. So they gave Gideon gold and he melted it down and made a kind of sacred relic, and the people began worshiping the relic. See, the Gideon story, as much as it's a celebration of God taking the side of the oppressed, it's not a great story. Freedom that comes through acts of violence is never, in the end, truly freedom. You see, the Midianites ended up dead. Towns ended up humiliated. Gideon ended up taking people's gold and kind of taxing them for his services, even though he was giving mouth to, yeah, God should be our king. And the Israelites ended up worshiping this gold thing that Gideon made. All Gideon did is turn the tables so that now the Midianites were the dead ones and the Israelites were the living ones. The Israelites were the ones that had the gold and the Midianites were the ones that were struggling. All he did is flip the tables. The oppressor became the oppressed. The oppressed became the oppressor. The story of the Exodus is like this also. Israel is celebrating because they are brought into freedom. They used to be slaves and now they're free. But in the process of becoming free, they humiliate and they kill a bunch of Egyptians. Now, we could say the Egyptians deserve it, but in the end, it's freedom from that which is harming us, but that causes harm on others. Freedom that comes through acts of violence is a lesser kind of freedom. This is freedom that comes in an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth world. So we might say that in an age of eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, the only kind of freedom that we can get is freedom that might restrain what can hurt us. But in the end, we are all left blind and bloodied in a world that is blind and bloodied. And so what the Bible longs for is something more, a new kind of age, something that breaks through the eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth logic, something that, a kind of freedom that comes not through violence and oppression, that doesn't come on the backs of others, that doesn't just simply turn the tables, but that makes possible a whole new kind of life. And so the book of Isaiah has all these images of God will act someday in such a way that a new creation will come about, and the lion will lay down with the lamb. There's two different places in Isaiah that talk about this. Isaiah 11:6 and Isaiah 65:25. Both images of animals that prey on, or one animal that preys on another. In Isaiah 65, it says the lion and the lamb will lay down together, will feed together, is the image. So the lion used to feed on the lamb, but in this new age, they'll be eating together. Picture that. There's a picture in Isaiah chapter 2 that there will be this age, this era when the people will beat their swords into plowshares. So what we used to use to kill one another, we're now going to use to work the earth and to flourish. That there will be an era where nation will no longer rise up against nation and there will be no more war. It's a longing for freedom that comes in some other way, not at the end of a sword, not turning the oppressor into the oppressed into the oppressor, and the oppressor into the oppressed. This would be an age characterized by genuine freedom and the fullness of life. So verse 5, it's very subtle, but it's there. Isaiah says, every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. You see, this freedom that comes as in the day of Midian, this overturning of tables, will be done in such a way that the warrior's boot used in battle, the garments rolled in blood, will be burned up, will disappear. Fire all through the book of Isaiah is an image of the judgment, the image of one era of the world passing away so that another era might come. All the things that we use to make war, all the demonstrations of one person asserting their dominance over another will be burned up, will be fuel for the fire. This freedom that God will grant someday, this new era, this new age that will come, that will free us from all that oppresses us, that will make us free for the good life, is going to come in some way that is not violent, that is not at the end of a sword, that is not on the backs of other people. And then the very next verse says, for unto us a child is born. And it's fitting, given the fact that freedom that comes at the end of a sword is never truly freedom. It's fitting that God would inaugurate this new age, bring about this new era through the birth of a child. A child is not capable. An infant is not capable of violence. An infant is totally dependent upon the care of his or her mother. And so this child is born into this hateful and violent world, this world on the edge of chaos. And even as before the child is 2 years old, a king is threatened by him and slaughters all the children in a village, trying to rid the earth of him. And you see, Jesus' whole life, not just his birth or not just the death on the cross, Jesus' whole life is this demonstration of a different kind of freedom. Rather than an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, Jesus demonstrates how to love our enemies, how to pray for those who persecute us. Jesus is free for the love of the neighbor, even when the neighbor is an enemy. Jesus throws parties that are inclusive of the religious and the sinner. Those that are excluded from community, Jesus heals and restores to community. And he spends his days teaching the Bible. And yet the religious authorities and the governmental authorities find him threatening, and early in his ministry conspire to kill him. This one who is bringing about a new age or a new era, those who have a stake in this age, in this era, see him as a threat. And so they pour out all the wrath they can on this child who is born, on this one who is given. And it goes to the cross, and they beat him mercilessly, and they hang him on a tree. And after they have poured out all the wrath, all the judgment that earthly powers can pour out, all the energy the government can spend to exclude those that are dangerous, they pour out everything. And when the dust settles, there's a dead body. But 3 days later, 3 days later, God raises Jesus from the dead. And Jesus becomes our picture, our example, our first fruits of the fact that what God accomplished in a manger is good and true. That there is now a new era, one that the powers of this age cannot destroy, one that there is no army that can overtake it. God has intervened, God has intersected, God has brought about a new way of life in Jesus. A kind of freedom that comes not at the point of a sword, not on the backs of others, but a freedom that comes purely and wholly and totally as gift from God. A new era. Freedom from our hatred and our selfishness and our self-centeredness. Freedom for love of our neighbor. And so rather than an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, which leaves us all blind and bloodied, God gave his son, who became bloodied and beaten, and who God restored to life, so that we might follow in his footsteps, in faith and in hope and in love. See, now at Christmas, we can sing, O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel. And we can also sing joy to the world, because the one who came to ransom Israel is also the one who came to ransom all of us from our hatred and our self-centeredness and our selfishness. We don't have to root for ourselves and then against others, but we can live in a new way following this new one who comes. We have been set free from all that restricts us from the fullness of life. But that fullness of life is a life lived in self-sacrifice and love for our neighbors. Let me encourage us this Christmas season to look forward to and to anticipate and to hope for and to pray for the coming of Jesus in more real and concrete ways in each of our lives. We have been set free, so let us live as ones that have been set free. Free from all that hurts us and restricts us. No matter what the powers might pour out on us, we know how the story ends. And that is, our God is the God who raises the dead. We don't need to protect. We can give.